Hello and welcome to the Morrissey Exchange podcast. The information contained within this podcast has been provided as general advice only and does not take into account any of your personal circumstances or objectives. You should consider if this advice is right for you and consult your financial advisor for further information.
Hello again and welcome to the fifth episode of the Morrissey Exchange podcast. I am here with my friend and contemporary Mr. Alex Henderson. Hello, Alex.
Good morning, Ben. How are you today?
I'm good, mate. So I thought we'd kick off today's discussion with some of the elephants in the room, and the first being the strength that a number of areas have shown in the market, some of the resources, some of the other areas like banks and REITs. What is the fundamental reason behind the strength kicking off?
Well, I think the main reason for the strength is the vaccine. So the vaccine for the COVID, you've seen Pfizer, Moderna coming out with some really strong results at the top of the month, right after the election, funnily enough. A few people a bit skeptical about the timing on that. So Pfizer, Moderna came out with about 90% success rate, which is pretty phenomenal. All pretty much owing to having more and more infections, unfortunately. So that's actually what saw their phase two and three trials accelerate. So, and then just recently we've seen AstraZeneca come out with a 70% success rate. Look, that one is obviously lower than the 90%, but it's a different type of vaccine. I'm no epidemiologist, obviously, but what you can see from there is that what we've heard is that that can be stored at a higher temperature. So that might be, you know, more beneficial or easier to administer.
So from a financial perspective or from an investment perspective, regardless of who's going to be first to the line to produce the vaccine, looks as though there's a few there, and it's provided an element of confidence and you know, exuberance in the markets, I suppose. So One of the areas we were talking about last time was, of course, oil. And I think at the time, oil was bouncing around that sort of $39 mark. It's pushed to the high 40s. I think it's sitting around the sort of mid-48 mark at the moment. So it's a reasonable rise. But when you compare the rise of the actual oil price, there's been greater confidence in the oil stocks themselves. You know, you've got Beach, which has been our favourite. It's been up, it's currently up around sort of 50-60%. Woodside's up around 30%. Santos in the 30s, Origin, Oil Search, etc., etc. It's interesting to see the magnification of the smaller rise in the oil price flowing through to the actual oil stocks themselves. So clearly the oil prices were being, the oil stocks were being held down too low. Yep. I suppose the other area is, of course, it's not just oil and gas, it's energy across the board. And one of the stocks we've been looking at, which was Whitehaven Coal, has kicked about 55-60% since the start of November and previously into October. So there's been a huge amount of strength pouring into these energy stocks, and it really does look as though it's been as a result of the confidence that's coming out as a result of the vaccine, and therefore we're going to get back to business as usual.
Yeah, that's right. And look, another sector that's done, and we spoke about it in the last pod as well, is the banking sector. So you've seen ANZ up 20-odd%, CBA the same, NAB a little bit more, and Westpac up about 14%. They're lagging a little bit, Westpac, I think maybe due to those the problems they had with the regulator. But their ex-dividend, apart from Commonwealth Bank, who have a different reporting period, so that's an even more impressive gain. So the investors will get their dividends in mid-December for those ones.
Yeah.
What else has caught your eye then?
Well, not only just the size of the numbers. I mean, we're really talking about a month here. We're into 20, 30, 40, 50, 60% gains on a lot of these things. And these are not speculative businesses. You know, these are very significant rises. But the other area, I suppose, is the property trusts or the real estate investment trust, which has been a favourite of ours because a fairly simple measures. You can measure them on a net tangible asset basis and the discount to which they're trading on that. And there was such a lack of confidence in the properties, particularly retail and office. And logically, they were the ones that were held down the most, and therefore they're the ones that have turned around the best. So you've got groups like Elanor Retail Fund, which, you know, recently sold an asset and they're now up sort of 35-36%. GDI's pushed up. The big one, I suppose, is the Gandel-dominated Vicinity Centres, which is up 35-40%. And, you know, there's obviously now an expectation that places like Chadstone are going to hold quite a few people over the course of the pre-Christmas spending rush. But, you know, overall, the real estate investment trust sector is up around 12-13%. I just wanted to circle back to one thing. So it's something that we wrote about in the weekly, and it was in relation to the coal price and China, and specifically the metallurgical coal price. So I previously referred to Whitehaven coal, which is 80% thermal coal and 20% coking coal. But can you explain what's going on within China and why there is such a divergence between prices on board from Australia compared to what's going on as far as other suppliers, other countries that are supplying China, and why such a massive gap between the prices?
It's a really interesting study. If you look at the Chinese government, there seem to be playing some sort of games against Australia for whatever reason. It might be political. Definitely is political, but
political.
So what we're seeing, and we're seeing a $103 coal price out of Australia for that met coal. It's $160 from US and Canada, and it's $200 if they source it from within China. So they're really cutting off their nose to spite their face.
So what you're saying is they're not buying from us; they're buying from the US, Canada. They're prepared to pay the $160, so they're biting off their nose to spite their face. But it's costing the businesses within China, but obviously the Chinese government are not too concerned about that.
No, that's right. And those businesses are doing the right thing by the government, or, you know, supposedly. But you know how much it's costing them? Could cost them up to $10 billion per annum to do this. So I can't see that lasting for too long. And at some stage, that $100 coal price out of Queensland, that should increase. And I think that's part of the reason around that strength in Whitehaven. You know, markets have cycles. We've spoken about that a lot with commodities. So we will see an uptick in that price at some stage.
Just on a final note, I know we've touched on commodities a bit here, but just in relation to iron ore, that price has held up, which is not what we expected. You know, we're expecting that iron ore price to slip back from the 120s down to sub $100. It's currently sitting at about 127. Can you give an explanation as to why it continues to hold up? I know we've touched on this in the past, but why is it still sitting around that 127?
Well, if you look at China, they're similar to Australia, I suppose, in that they're funding or they're having a lot of infrastructure projects. And what we're seeing is there's a lot of steel production. So what those steel mills are doing, they're just buying up whatever they can in iron ore. And another part of that is that the actual Chinese yuan has appreciated against the US dollar. And that's where the iron ore price is sourced. So they're just producing steel at a rapid rate, and that's why that has kept in those at those lofty levels.
So they're pushing infrastructure. So obviously they're trying to get growth back on track within China, which seems to be the same old strategy and has been incredibly effective, of course, over the course of the last 30-plus years, that they just keep building. So they keep buying, keep building. Yeah, it's interesting. We've been really strong on this, inverted commas, fade the iron ore price. It just hasn't happened. There's been such extraordinary upheaval around the world, and as a result of it, there have been government-led measures, whether from places like China or the US or Australia, but the sort of demand that's been coming for the iron ore stocks as well is just what we didn't expect. We just didn't expect the level of continued demand to be there for the iron ore, and therefore the iron ore price has held up a lot longer than what we expected. However, it is still a cyclical commodity, and in time it looks as though it'll probably still slip back down again. But for the moment, it's holding a lot better than what we expected.
Exactly. And look, leading on from all those outperformers, what in the last month there has been a few underperformers. What are you seeing in that, you know, underperforming against the ASX? What are you seeing there?
It really intrigues me the way markets have changed over the last couple of years. You know, there's just such a wave of buying. You know, we don't get businesses being chosen. We still do to some degree, but we don't get specific businesses being purchased as a result of the quality of that particular business. We see a wave of buying in sectors, and what we're really seeing is a plus and a minus. You've got risk on and risk off. Mm. So the money rolls into the market when risk is on, and it rolls out of the market when it's risk off. So when we were risk off, that's when we saw the likes of gold stocks and those sorts of products or areas or sectors that are considered defensive. That's where the support is and that's where the money went. And that's one of the reasons we were so strong on buying gold, because I still believe we've got a situation at the moment where we're going to see a huge amount of money supply. Mm. And with that money supply, within inflation likely to hover around that sort of 1.5-2% mark, we've got negative real rates. In that sort of an environment, you get outperformance of gold. So in the short term, fine, we've seen gold prices decline, and as a result, the gold stocks have declined. And it's a natural reaction. It's a perfectly logical reaction to this risk-on trade that the market's taking. The vaccine looks as though it's going to be the great white hope. Everyone's getting optimistic again. Economies are going to rebuild. So where does that money come from? It comes from places like gold. The interesting one, though, is a lot of money has started to pour out of the tech stocks, the big tech stocks, which I would have thought were the risk-ons, but in a weird way, they've actually been seen as the risk-offs. They're the safer ones that the market seems to consider, okay, well, we're going to back away from those big tech stocks and we're going to start to roll back into the cyclical stocks like the, you know, the oil and gas and the other businesses like the banks and the real estate investment trusts, which had underperformed up until this point.
So the market PE at the moment, and we're on a total shareholder return of around 5-odd percent. So our market's what, in the high PE, high 19 PEs, or about 27 excluding banks and miners. So one thing to look at is the actual price to book, and that looks okay at these levels. So that's the actual assets that are backing those. So that is actually measured, whereas the TSR looks at what a target price is for an analyst. I know that that's something that we do use here at Shore, and you know, you and I use that quite a bit.
That is a high PE. I mean, yep, with a market running at 19 times X the bank, so what that means is, you know, if you exclude the banks and the miners from that market PE, you're looking at 27, 28 times. That's really high. Mm. There are justifications for it. I get that. You know, you can say that, all right, there is no alternative scenario where either you put your money into the market where you can get a dividend yield, you know, averaged out over the course of the next couple of years of maybe 3-5%. Property is another alternative where people could go to. But outside of that, you've got fixed interest sitting at record lows. You've got, you know, term deposit cash. You're barely getting anything out of it. It is definitely forcing people up the risk curve. So you're starting to see more money pouring into the equity markets that hadn't been going into these areas in the past. But notwithstanding that, it's still expensive. So it does worry me that you're looking at PE sitting up at these levels. I do think we're, to some degree, hitting our head on the glass ceiling at the moment. And I think we're due for a period of consolidation, particularly after the last couple of months of strength, optimism. We're rolling into a Northern Hemisphere winter where there's probably going to be some pretty nasty increases in infection rates, as you know, as you'd expect, which is exactly what was happening over here during our winter. And that could suck the life out of this recovery to some degree. But of course, we have the vaccine behind it. So yeah, it's a bit of a balancing act at the moment. I think we've probably run a little bit fast. But notwithstanding that, the businesses across the board are generally doing relatively well. And one of the ways you can assess that, or one of the ways that the companies themselves show that they're doing well, is via on-market buybacks or special dividends or bigger dividends. And yeah, I just ran a list before. I wrote down a number of the companies that we follow particularly closely and how many of them are doing on-market buybacks. So you've got GDI, which is a property group, CIMIC, an infrastructure company. I mean, they've been doing a buyback since Jesus was a boy. You've got Aurora, South 32, KKC, Eleanor Retail Fund, Coventry, although they haven't bought it, they've announced it. Brambles, you know, they've got one on the way at the moment, but hasn't been a selection of ours. And it's good to look back at stocks like Fortescue. You know, when we were first buying Fortescue and they were out of favour, and, you know, we've been through this story in the past, but the company themselves thought that they were cheap too. So they were doing a buyback at the same time we were buying the stock. And I think it augurs well when you look at what executives within these businesses are thinking. If they think the business is cheap, generally this sort of insider movement suggests that those businesses are cheap. So anyway, it's just another measure to keep an eye on that. There are good on-market buybacks. Yes, I'm saying the market does look relatively expensive at the moment, but these companies believe that their businesses are cheaper than other alternatives that they can look at as far as where the money is best spent.
That's right. So I suppose a lot of these companies, they've got choices to make. So what do they do with that cash and what's the best use of those shareholder funds? Is it going out and buying another business where, you know, we've seen very high PEs, so they've got the potential there to overpay? Is it by a special dividend, you know, a bit of a sugar hit to investors, or, you know, reinvesting that money back into the business where they know, you know, they know what they're getting, so they're actually investing back there, and that should actually grow the business in the long term. And you see it in the United States a lot. They don't pay huge dividends, but they do special corporate management where they might be buying the stock back. And another one there was Link, actually, and they were buying the stock back quite aggressively around that $4 or $3 mark. And they've since then had a takeover. Not saying it's the leading or cause of that, but it's another way that they can show confidence in their business and show confidence to shareholders as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, it's just an indicator that, you know, if the business, if the management of the business believe their business is cheap, they conduct on market buybacks, and it could be just another indicator that shows you that that particular stock is cheap. Doesn't necessarily mean there'll be corporate activity, but it does give an insight into what they're thinking about their own business. Just a final thing to touch on, the Victorian government passed down their budget, which, you know, was pretty hairy and covered in warts, but, you know, there's substantial budget spending. This government, it looks as though, both from a federal perspective, we're spending there, but statewide, looks as though we're going to spend sort of $49, $50 billion, or that was the proposed budget spending, with $5-odd billion in social housing. You got $5-odd billion for the Melbourne Airport Rail Link, which had been put on ice for God knows how long. There's any number of different infrastructure spending proposals, which I'll touch on later. Did you have anything that you wanted to touch on from the budget itself?
I do. The interesting one is it's the first deficit since 2012-13. That was only $0.3 billion. Now we're at $6.5 billion. So look, I'm not saying it needs to be done. So this is the way out of the hole. So they need to spend, they being the government. Next year it'll be $23.3 billion, and the payback, decades. And that came from Minister Pallas himself. So the idea around all these deficits is, of course, job creation. So 400,000 jobs, hopefully by 2025. The other part of this is the downgrade probably to the investment rating. So you're looking at Standard & Poor's as well as Moody's potentially cutting our credit rating there. It will be an infrastructure-led spending. So they haven't released anything specific. Sorry, a lot of the papers released. I think that'll be in May or April. I think they leaked a few of those other ones previously. But they're going to be spending $19.4 billion in 2021. And that's a 61% increase on the last year, which I found really interesting. And that was, of course, with level crossings and the Metro Tunnel. So that's a big area of focus. One other thing just to keep in mind is that debt. So I looked back in 1987. Can you guess what our debt was back then, Ben?
No, I can't.
No. $9.1 billion. So in 2021, it'll be $86.7 billion. 2024, it'll be $154.8 billion. Now, how much does that cost to pay back? If you're having to pay it back at 12% interest rates like you had in 1987, that would be $1.1 billion per annum. In 2021, it'll only be $814 million with such low interest rates, even at 0.9%. They do need to do this, the governments, they do need to spend, and it's not costing them as much. So this is the path that they've chosen, and it makes sense.
Yeah, look, it does. We just better hope inflation doesn't run away too quickly because, you know, historically, governments will increase interest rates to try and stamp out too much inflation, but it's their own balance sheets that are riddled with debt this time. So I imagine the central banks around the world would be reluctant to allow interest rates to go up too soon because they'd be bankrupting themselves in the whole process. So it does look as though the way out of this, the way out of this stunning level of debt that we have accumulated across the Western world is spending. It sounds counterintuitive, but it looks as though whilst interest rates are as low as what they are, we just got to spend our way out. For mine, from a greedy or a more focused perspective, that just means infrastructure in Australia. And there's just so much money to be spent on so many different infrastructure projects in this country. It was a favourite area of ours. We could see it coming anyway. You know, it's been happening for the last 5 years, but it's now become somewhat exacerbated over the last sort of 6 to 12 months. And we know that there is just going to be a staggering amount of money spent on infrastructure. And it just shows you must be exposed to infrastructure. Infrastructure businesses themselves, those companies that supply the widgets that are used in infrastructure, those companies that supply all sorts of different products, you know, the staffing, all of it. It is absolutely going to be an area of growth and possibly one of the few areas of growth over this most unusual period.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
All right, that probably sees us out. We've exceeded 20 minutes again. It's extraordinary how this time flies. But look, thank you so much for listening to us. If you've got any queries, please feel free to send either of us an email. You can look us up on our website, which is www.morrisseygroup.net. Otherwise, we'll speak to you soon. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Ben.
The Morrisey Group is a corporate authorised representative of Shaw & Partners Limited, ABN 24003221583. Our financial services guide is viewable at www.shawandpartners.com.au. Any content within this podcast is subject to the terms and conditions of Shaw & Partners Limited's disclaimer, as viewable at www.shawandpartners.com.au/disclaimer.